Welcome back to Embracing Your Mortality podcast with me, author Sue Brain. On the first of the month, I post an interview with someone who is passionate about helping us to live more consciously for a better world. And my goodness me, we all need as much inspiration and hope we can get these days amongst the chaos that we're all going through. And this is why I'm so delighted that my guest today is Robert Pardy, who's an author, a life coach and mentor, whose passion and commitment is to help people to understand that personal growth and transformation is just part of the human experience. He writes, "The arc of all our journeys involve confronting challenges, learning lessons, winning victories, and returning transformed as a symbol of what is possible." Robert's own journey started when growing up with an alcoholic father and all that entails, but he says his awakening happened when his 31-year-old wife, who was a palliative care doctor, was diagnosed with breast cancer, which then metastasized. And Robert became her full-time carer and turned to journaling to help him make sense of what was happening for him. Welcome, Robert. I'm really interested in how journaling has helped you so much, and I want to come back to that. But first, you talk very honestly about how living with your alcoholic father taught you some vital life lessons and how that's helped you to sustain your life as you grew up and dealt with the really difficult experience with your wife. And I just wanted to start with that. You know, the concept of living with a really dysfunctional parent and what that does to us.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I absolutely love the work you're doing. I love the focus of the podcast. So, you know, people find it very odd because when I do talk about my childhood, yes, I grew up with an abusive alcoholic dad. And, you know, there were two paths. There could have been the path of letting that define me in a negative way or a positive way. And I will say that his mother, my paternal grandmother, was the one at my side telling me not to be like him, showing me or explaining to me, look, he's the anti-role model. But when you're in that situation, as a kid, I could have never defined it. But you know, you learn about resilience, you learn about grit, you learn about uncertainty, you learn about managing change. And while I, let's say, didn't have the traditional childhood because I couldn't have friends over the house or anything like that, and I hid a lot of what was going on, very few people ever knew except my best friend, because I would run to his house sometimes just like sleep there because it just was out of hand. But that, in a way, those experiences forced me, and I will say forced, because I felt like I had to make a decision to say, okay, you know what? The only way this changes is for me to take action to make it change. Mm-hmm. And I was fueled by anger. I will say that anger is a motivating fuel. It is not sustainable whatsoever, but it was what allowed me, one, to fight back when I was strong enough, and then my father didn't touch me again. But the anger is what fueled me to study as hard as I could. And as a child of that epoca, right? So there was Dynasty, Dallas, the Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, Ronald Reagan, money in my mind was going to be the saving ticket. So I said, all right, I'm going to go work on Wall Street because the more money I have, the safer I will be. That's what the child inside me was saying. Wow. And so that's what I did. I didn't pursue finance because it was a passion, but it was the way I felt I could control life and I would always have enough money to save myself. So those lessons allowed me to learn how to consciously direct life. And we cannot change what's happening. Like with my dad, I couldn't get rid of him. You know, I was a kid, I had to live in that house, but I learned how to deal with it. I learned how to plan for the future. I learned to make those conscious choices of what my tomorrow would look like. And that's really what allowed me to build the rest of my life. We talked about my wife, but it's everything. And believe it or not, as a kid, I didn't journal the way I journal today, but I needed some outlet because I couldn't talk to anybody about it.
That's really interesting. So you put it down on paper, and I'm just so conscious of, I know I've talked, I've worked with a lot of people who are children of alcoholics, and when I was a psychotherapist, and this whole concept of safety comes up, you know, what's safe? Who am I? How can I feel safe when the role models that you look up to and you inverted commas in the ideal world should respect and care for you and not present? And that really is impactful, isn't it?
It's incredibly impactful. I truly was blessed because I did have my grandmother, which she was just an incredible dynamic woman. I never knew my grandfather, who passed away before I was born. And here she was, a 4'9", you know, Sicilian woman that only finished the fourth grade and yet had so much wisdom and really did teach me so much. Then my best friend's father worked for the US government, and he was my parental figure, let's say. And so I had that as well, because one of the things I learned, and this does come from my grandmother, about the anti-role model, I started reading voraciously, and I was reading to find people I admired. I needed to find what was that symbol I was supposed to become. In my mind, you know, I had the superhero thing in mind, right? Like, you know, Superman and all that other stuff, because that was the identity I was trying to grab onto as a child. But as I got a little older, I started looking at, well, what are those qualities that, in my mind, make a man a man? Because I didn't have that in my life. And, you know, my mom and I are close, but, you know, there was this situation where my father would get drunk, he would beat me, and then my mom would ask me to go apologize to him for making him angry. So there was that dynamic of, okay, there's nobody that's understanding what it's like for me. And this is something anybody listening to this, we do talk ourselves into existence through the stories we tell ourselves. So as a kid, I started telling myself, well, I am the soldier, I am the fighter, you know, I don't need to tell anybody this. That's what fueled the anger, but that was the identity or the cloak I wore to get me through a certain period of time. You know, when there was a time later in life that my father reached out to me to sort of, you know, try to have a normal relationship, and he wrote me a letter. And this is hard for a lot of people to hear, but I do truly believe in boundaries. At that point in time, I had found my agency, my personal strength, whatever you would say. And he wrote me a letter, and I wrote him back, and I said, write me a few more, and if I do believe you've changed, I'll write you back. And he never wrote me another letter.
I mean, so the big thing
we never had that relationship.
Yeah, with that alcoholic parent is boundaries, because they don't have any.
Yeah.
And it's obviously that's what you needed to do for yourself, to put your own boundary down with him. And he obviously hadn't changed.
No, not at all. You know, when he did pass away, I wasn't there. I hadn't spoken to him in years. I do understand, you know, and of course, as I've grown, the situation with my wife and all of that, I understand so much and how unhappy he was. But that doesn't mean that I put myself in a situation to sacrifice my well-being.
Yeah.
And so I'm even the work I do with my clients, a lot of it, and it doesn't have to do with that, it just has to do with life in general. We need to set boundaries.
It's stepping out of the victim, rescuer, persecutor triangle, isn't it? Stop being the victim to that. And actually, no, I'm not going to do that. And having the courage to face the guilt and the shame and all it goes with, to say, no, I need to be me, not you, not saving you or appeasing you or being frightened of you anymore.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's in it's life influence. That's your story. That's what you've brought into your life and how you've worked it. And I know you married young and you met your soulmate, and then yes. She was diagnosed. I can't imagine what that was like for you.
The incredible thing was, it literally was at the height of our everything. I use that phrase, but you know, Desiree and I met, she was 17, I was 19. And it was, we were just that couple that was always together. I went to her classes, she went to my classes, you know, it was those people you look at and you're like, oh, that's so sappy, you know? And the thing is, we grew up together. So when she was diagnosed, which was completely out of the blue, I had just gotten an amazing job in the Middle East. She was in the MD PhD program at Mount Sinai in New York City. And just everything was like right there for us to have. And when she was diagnosed, I have to say, you know, everything, you know, it was a sucker punch, but there was still that idea of we can take care of this. And my wife was very strong. She was very strong-willed. What I went through with my dad, you know, it was like, okay, resilience, grit, let's bring that all in. It was when it metastasized that for me, that was just something that I couldn't fathom. Because at that point in time, I realized no matter what I do, no matter how much money, no matter whatever, this is so far out of my control now. It's not like, okay, let's go get the surgery. Let's go get the radiation. Let's do this. Let's do that. And then, you know, now it's spread. Mm-hmm. This could be chronic. Most likely it's terminal. And the unusual thing about the journey with Desiree is that when she was diagnosed, because she was in medical school, she said to me, she said, Robert, look, I know of enough to be dangerous to myself, enough of medicine to be dangerous to myself. So I don't want to know anything about my disease. It was not until the very end that she knew the size of the tumor, the number of lymph nodes, 12 out of 12. She knew nothing about it. She didn't want to know. She just wanted to show up, be a patient, do her best. And I spoke with the doctors. So as the cancer was spreading, I was living her disease for her.
Gosh.
To help make sure she was living the life that I knew she wanted. And that's the whole weird thing in this, because yes, I was her caregiver to a certain extent. She was very self-sufficient. She became the founding director of palliative care at New York Hospital with metastatic breast cancer. So it's not that she needed me to take care of her, but when I left my career, I left my career to support her to achieve her dreams. Mm. That's how I became a life coach, because I indirectly became her life coach.
So you're sort of caring for her, and that's why you've the sort of the mentoring, the coaching, and then you took that into a completely different way of living life.
Yes. So what I realized through my journey is how I look at it a few ways. One, you know, the loss of a loved one really does create rubble. Oof. And there's two things we can do, right? We can look at that. And there's also a great lesson here. And that's one of the reasons why I love your podcast in terms of mortality. Impermanence liberates us. It is the most liberating thing if we really do embrace it. You know, when you're sitting there and you're frustrated, it's a way to actually change your energy completely, thinking, okay, but this could be my last day. Do I want to spend it frustrated? Right. So, but here was all this rubble. And what I realized is there's really two options: trying to piece that rubble back together to have some semblance of what our life was supposed to be. So, quote, expectations, or taking that rubble and saying, wow, with curiosity, I'm going to start to build a mosaic. And the reason I use a mosaic is because when I did come to Rome, when I was in the phase of reimagining my life, I was in this beautiful church called San Clemente. I was looking at this ancient mosaic floor. And the closer I looked, I realized that each piece was imperfect. But it was the imperfections that made the beauty of the mosaic. It's what it actually gave it its depth, right? So I was sitting here and saying, I have two options, trying to make it still look like it was supposed to be, or say those expectations don't exist anymore. What could it be? And I realized in that, and I say this a lot, I'm a big acronym person, and one of my acronyms is LOSS, which I say is the lack of self. We lose our identity and security. The world feels unsafe because of the big loss. So I said, okay, the husband, Robert, died with Desiree, the wife. But what was it that I liked about myself as the husband? And one of the things that kept coming up is supporting her. And I said, wow, okay, I want to live a life then where I'm in support, where I'm in service. And funny enough, I did go back to the Middle East. I did go back to finance because I had a lot of debt. You know, an 11-year journey with cancer is not cheap. So she did not have life insurance. But I said, okay, I need to pay off my debt. And as soon as I did, and I decided to reimagine life, I really, the question I asked myself was not, what if I fail? It was, what if I make this happen? Like, what's a cool story I could look back on when I'm on my deathbed? And it was to move to Rome and just move to Italy and change everything. I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anyone. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to live. I just showed up here. I started teaching English for $8 an hour until I got my coaching certificate and built what I built. But it was the wonder and curiosity of, wow, can I put the pieces together and build this mosaic? Instead of looking at it as, ugh, I have all these broken pieces, I'm overwhelmed. Mm. It's not easy. I learned a lot of things. I pulled a lot of things from my childhood. And that's how I built my coaching practice, based on that.
So in your coaching practice, what do you particularly specialize in, helping people through loss, or is it just general, or what happens for you?
That's a great question, because I don't specialize in people suffering from loss, but it is more about transformation. And so if you think about it, when I became a coach, and because of who my wife was, she was on the front page of the New York Times when she passed away. So the palliative care community knew me very well. When I became a coach, it was, hey, Robert, here are clients. And what I realized is I'm the guy, whether it's loss or anything else, is, are you tired of chewing on that uncomfortable sandwich or that disgusting sandwich or whatever you want to call it? You know, I call it the grief sandwich when I'm in the grief space. Are you tired of chewing on that? Because if you are, let's spit that out and let's find out what you want to do next. So I'm the next guy.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like you have to go through this, a loss, a profound loss, to find yourself. It's almost like the loss strips away all the rubbish, the stuff that really doesn't matter, but you kind of think it does. And then bingo, so gone or so destroyed or broken or whatever. And then it's that, the process of that, that carries you into, oh, this is who I am.
And part of it is even the discovery of who we are, right? But what you said is so critical. When you suffer a big loss, it does wash away the unnecessary, for sure. You're like, what have I been doing? Especially, that's why impermanence, embracing our mortality, understanding we are on a train that has an endpoint. So if we want to really be, you know, jarring with our language, we all have a terminal disease. Why are we waiting for a doctor to give us a piece of paper for us to wake up? So that idea that you said of when someone suffers loss, then it's like, oh, there's actually a process that you can get to that, oh, without having the loss. And it is start to understand your values and understand the work I do, regardless of where somebody is, it's usually what's the story you want to look back on. And you have to start, no matter what age we are as adults, you have to start with daydreaming. Daydreaming is non-threatening. Daydreaming is a gift we've been given. Imagination is a gift we've been given as children to actually craft a future. And so sit in that space a little bit, things start to come up, and then you reverse engineer. But once you connect to that story you want to look back on your deathbed, that's the oh moment without getting the doctor's, you know, diagnosis.
I think a lot of people, because of what's happening in the world, are waking up to going, blimey, hang on a minute, what really is important? Because all of this may go, and we don't know with the outcome of what's happening. But, you know, you'd have to be, I mean, just have your head, you know, so buried in the sand not to be acutely aware of the massive chaos and change that we're going through. And for me, experiencing loss is all about that sense of total chaos. Yes. Everything's thrown up in the air. You don't know how the jigsaw pieces are going to land, like you're talking about, you know, the mosaic that it's going to make. But it's hard, and it's frightening, and it's scary, and it's lonely.
The
journey was lonely, really lonely. And it's how do we, you know, help? I suppose that's when you've been through it and you've come out the other side that you can really say, it's okay, I've survived, I'm all right now.
In a different way. So I just look, two things. I love the word blimey, by the way, that you use blimey. I absolutely love that. So yes, it is. It is blimey, right? Now, here's the thing. We believe we have some semblance of control, but the pieces really are always in the air. We can project and fantasize and so forth, but we really don't know what the outcomes are going to be. And so I joke all the time of, can you really make a mistake? Like if you take a chance now to build something, you will die and it will still be unfinished. Like, we never know what the outcome is really going to be because we don't know when time is going to finish. If we know, okay, at 85, I'm going to leave this earth so I can plan for this to, but, you know, just let it unfold, right? But those pieces are sort of always in the air. The other thing about the loneliness, and I think this work, which is why I love this work, I love what you're doing, is we're examples, right, of coming through the tunnel. But the loneliness aspect of it is one, as a society, we really don't know how to talk about loss. Two is our instinct is to jump in and try to fix. And you know what? We're not objects. We never need fixing. And like you said, you come out of the tunnel whole, but different. You've integrated the loss, but you're different than you were. So you're, when I say whole, what I'm meaning is you're integral, you're integrated with everything that has happened. And that's really who we are. We're pieces of fabric, right? So every experience we have is woven into the fabric of what we are. Those losses, sometimes they're really big pieces of fabric. We could think of it as, you know, a thick piece of wool or something. And then we come out of it and people see it, but nobody really wants to know the steps because it's, ooh, I don't want to know what happens in that tunnel because no, it scares me or it's uncomfortable. Or, you know, I grew up, most of my family was Sicilian, and the men, when there was a funeral, they would wear the black bands on their arm, the very Italian thing or Italian-American thing. I've never seen it here in Italy, so I don't know, maybe it's just my crazy family. But we actually had conversations about death. And now everyone wants to sort of just, you know, ignore any of the difficult conversations, and we don't grow from that. Then we feel very alone when we're sitting in that space.
I think in my experience, when everything blows up or there's a, you know, a massive life quake or a life collapse or whatever you want to talk, however you want to, it's like, it's so existential, I think. It's almost like you can't put my feelings were so out of anything that there was no container for them. I think that's what it was. And I couldn't put into words what I was feeling because I'd never been there before.
Right.
And not really. I mean, I'd sort of obviously had deep feelings and all sorts of stuff, but this particularly blew me apart. and it's that sense of, you know, the wonderful archetype of Pluto. You know, Pluto took me by the hand and drew me down into his underworld. and walked me through this underworld until he popped me back up again on the surface, going, what was that about? Help! And it's sort of this sense of total aloneness, isn't it? It's like, it's great to talk to other people who've also been through it. I think you talk about the importance of talking with other people that have had similar experiences.
Yes. Yes. That is something you might be familiar. Have you ever heard of the Death Cafe?
I run them.
Oh,
yeah.
You run them. Okay. Yeah. So that I didn't know.
Well,
that was
well over 100. Yes.
Okay. All right. So important. And this is just something anyone listening here, actually, I think sharing any experience is important. Because we are all dealing with similar situations. Of course, all our situations can be different because we all have our own beliefs, limiting beliefs, you know, experiences and so forth. But, you know, we will feel more connected. Now, one of the things that when I run, let's say, you know, the group programs and stuff, is it really is more about that, you know, you share and you witness. A lot of times, like you said, you know, your emotions, you couldn't even define them. You couldn't define what was going on, but you wanted to be seen. And it, for this piece of your life to realize, I am here in this vortex of things. I have no idea what's going on. I feel very alone. Does anyone see me? I don't need fixing. I don't need advice, but does anyone just see me right now? Because I feel like I'm just floating out here by myself.
Yeah.
That is so powerful.
I think certainly, you know, with the death cafes and listening to so many people's stories about loss and grief, and, you know, also having worked as a psychotherapist, and, you know, my journey took me into working like that. I wanted to be there for other people who are really suffering from whatever they were going through. I sort of feel like when we come together, it takes us out of our story is really important, but what we're doing, we're witnessing the human condition.
Exactly.
And that's what we're doing. Look, mate, everybody goes through something. Nobody gets out of here free with a free pass. You just don't. You have to walk the fire. That's part of the human condition. And we could go into a huge conversation about the esoteric now and existentialism, which unfortunately we don't, but I have time for this conversation. But I think that's what it is, isn't it? It's about, I am a human being having this human experience, and so are you.
Yes. Yes. That's, somebody once asked me, because, you know, I could have stayed in finance and had a very nice life and everything else, and I decided to do this. And they're like, why do you do this? And, you know, you talk about your own loss and all this other stuff. And I said, well, what value would my stories have if I just held on to them? It's like, you know, my mom has a curio cabinet in her house with all these little figurines and stuff, and she has them all there and they're locked closed and nobody touches them. You know, I grew up with the plastic on the furniture as well, you know, that crazy thing. But, you know, so they're all in there and they're sort of getting dusty, and, you know, and it's like, what value do they really have just locked away? And so it is hard for a lot of people, because we also, there's a whole confusion about vulnerability and sharing stories and, you know, not showing that maybe you're suffering or whatever it is. It's that human experience. We're all having this experience in different stages, in different colors. That's the true diversity, right? If we just start sharing all of it, wow, are we adding a lot of color to the canvas?
What a perfect place to end this conversation. I've absolutely loved talking with you, Robert. Thank you so much. So that was Robert Pardy. He's the author of Possibility in Action, a really wonderful book about how you can help yourself going through a major transition. And you can find out more about his other books, or you can contact him through his website, robertpardy.com. My September guest is a wonderful woman called Madison, or more commonly known as Maddie King, who is an internationally recognized master practitioner, teacher, writer, and educator of the Donna Eden Method, which helps people to access their natural healing energies. So I'll see you with Maddie on the 1st of September, and thanks for listening. Bye for now.